This is the Yahoo Sports Boxing Podcast. A look inside the sweet science with Chris Mannix.
I will be always remembered as a winner.
Interviews.
Fran Freddie Roach, Hall of Fame trainer.
Analysis.
That is the thing Floyd's talking about right now.
And everything going on in the world of boxing.
I would have liked him to get to the bell to see what was what.
Post a rating or leave a comment on iTunes.
He smells bad.
About the podcast.
Oh.
And now a man who several people would like to punch in the face repeatedly. Chris Mannix.
All right, my guest this week, you've heard him here before. You can read him on BoxingScene.com. Keith Idek, one of the best boxing writers out there. What's up, Keith?
Hey, Chris, how you doing, man? Appreciate you having me on.
I appreciate you being here. A lot to get into today. As always, anybody that wants to subscribe to this podcast, check us out over at iTunes. And while you're there, just post a comment, leave a rating, all that good stuff that helps us out every single week. All right, Keith, I want to begin with the ever-evolving story that is Canelo Alvarez and Gennady Golovkin. Last week, I was talking with Kevin Ioli about this, and this was after Golovkin just napalmed Canelo, you know, calling him a cheat, calling Oscar De La Hoya a cheat. The latest development is that the Nevada Commission has temporarily suspended Canelo for this fight. So as of right now, there is no fight on May 5th. Canelo is going to have to come either by in person or by phone sometime next month and explain his positive test. Now, I think it's a good move by the Nevada Commission, a move I didn't expect them to take. But do you really believe that this fight is in serious jeopardy?
I don't, Chris. I don't think it's in serious jeopardy. I think they're following their rules and regulations. They're calling a hearing. They're giving, even though Gennady Golovkin doesn't want the fight postponed or canceled, they're giving due process for, you know, for Canelo Alvarez to show that it came from contaminated meat. They're going to give him his opportunity to present that evidence, the experts that they may bring with them. And I think we'll move forward with the fight on May 5th. There is a groundswell, though, of people in our industry that think that this fight is going to be postponed.
Yeah, I mean, is it because that they think the Nevada Commission is going to take a stand? I mean, look, we both talk to a lot of people in this business, and I'm sure you're hearing a lot of the same stuff that I am. I mean, I come across more people that think Canelo is a cheater than those that think that Canelo just ate tainted meat. Now, you know, people in the boxing business can be vindictive. They certainly can, you know, pick sides. And I think there are a lot of people kind of rooting for Canelo to lose. But, you know, the idea that it would be postponed, would that be because the commission actually shows a bit of a spine in a situation like this, is willing to, you know, forego, at least temporarily, you know, potentially tens of millions of dollars that run through Las Vegas?
You know, Chris, I think it would be an unforeseen turn of events if they did, as you said, show a spine here and postpone this fight. Because if they do move forward with the suspension and they suspend him for 6 months, then this fight wouldn't happen in September either. So it'd be a pretty big step for them to take, particularly when there's so much money at stake for so many people involved, including the state of Nevada, which makes a lot of money off of ticket taxes. They make a lot of money off the television taxes. Obviously, the economy, you know, gets a boost from people coming into town for the fight. So there's a lot at stake for everyone involved, including the state of Nevada. But it would be unusual, I think, if they did that, and it would show that they've been serious all along about this and that it's not some dog and pony show, as it's been referred to by a lot of people who don't take them seriously at all.
Yeah, and I'm one of those people. I don't take the Nevada Commission all that seriously because, well, and it's not just the Nevada Commission. I don't know if I take any commission seriously because, you know, very few, if any, commissions have shown backbone in these particular situations. They've always chosen money over, you know, protecting the integrity of the process. And look, I want to see Canelo Golovkin too. I think it's one of the best fights you can make in boxing. The first fight wasn't great. I think the second fight has the potential maybe to be better. But there has to be some kind of punishment for this, right? I mean, unless Canelo's got the receipts, unless he can show exactly when and how he ate tainted meat, there has to be some kind of punishment. I mean, Keith, we've been watching over the last, you know, couple of years, really, where guys test positive and nothing comes of it. Go back to Eric Morales in New York. Even Luis Ortiz, I mean, he tests positive before the Wilder fight, and there's literally no punishment. He gets a tune-up fight, and he gets the Wilder fight several months later. I mean, there has to be some type of penalty and some type of reason to deter guys from taking PEDs, because if there is no punishment for this, what's to stop the next guy from doing the exact same thing that maybe Canelo did, knowing that there's no stick that's going to hit him at the end of this? So I hope the Nevada Commission actually does suspend Canelo for 6 months and forces this fight either till December or even 2019.
You know, Chris, it would be, again, unusual if they do that. But as you said, somebody has to take a stand at some point to let these guys know that you can't just do this without any repercussions. And thus far, there really haven't been any repercussions for any of these guys. The guys that you just mentioned, Luis Ortiz, other guys who've claimed that contaminated meat made clenbuterol come into their systems, and other guys who've used other excuses similar to that. It would be nice to see someone take a stand, but there's just so much money at stake that I just don't see it happening. And look, if they were going to postpone the fight, I understand they have to go through the due process of having an open meeting and all that, but they probably would have just postponed it, you know, 3 weeks ago when this mm-hmm. happened, as opposed to letting it drag on to the point where you're less than a month out for the fight. It just seems like an odd time to cancel a fight 3 weeks in advance. When, there's so much money at stake for a lot of entities involved in this, I just can't see them doing that.
Okay, so to you, though, you know, regardless of what happens with this fight, is Canelo Alvarez's reputation permanently stained by this? Is he going to be branded for, you know, the rest of his career as a cheater?
Whether he likes it or not, yes, Chris. I think people will never forget this. Some people will buy his excuse, you know, his fans clearly will, his hardcore fan base, of course, they're going to accept what he tells them. You know, the skeptics among us are going to have questions forever about him.
Are you a skeptic?
I think I'm skeptical of all professional athletes at this point. I think you have to be to some degree based on how much money is at stake in all of these sports and all of their shelf lives being so, you know, they're just short and they have to maximize their earning potential in a short amount of time. And I think it's so tempting to a lot of guys that it's hard to say no. I really commend the guys who do it clean, and whether it's boxing or baseball or football or whatever sport it is. But, Chris, as reporters, we're naturally skeptical people anyway. But mm-hmm. I think you'd have to be skeptical of anyone. I don't have any evidence in terms of what Canelo Alvarez is doing in training or what he's not doing. So I'm not pointing a finger at him in particular. But I just think you have to have a healthy amount of skepticism for any athlete. And in this sport, when really, Chris, it's not about how many home runs you hit and where you finish on a list at the end of your career. You could kill someone if your body is enhanced by performance-enhancing drugs. It's much more serious, in my opinion, in boxing than it is in baseball. You know, football obviously is a dangerous sport also, but there's no sport more dangerous than boxing. And something needs to be done about this. As you said before, if the Nevada Commission isn't going to take a stand here, when is someone going to take a stand? Because no one's done it thus far.
It's amazing that the sport where safety should be at a premium when it comes to, you know, catching guys and punishing guys for using performance-enhancing drugs is one of the worst on this particular issue when it comes to punishment. And look, there was a part of me that wanted to believe and maybe still wants to believe that Canelo was just stupid, that he was at, you know, I don't know where he was. That's some kind of burrito bar and just ate tainted meat somewhere. In Mexico, but there's just so much reason to be skeptical. I mean, from what I've been reading, a lot of the tainted meat stuff happens in Mexico City, and that's not where Canelo, you know, does his training camp. And even if it was, you know, this has been an ongoing problem. This is, you know, 6-7 years of this type of stuff coming up, and Canelo runs his training camp in an incredibly disciplined way. I mean, he's had the same group of guys around him for a long time. I mean, you're telling me they're not keenly aware of this problem? If it was accidental, that's what makes me even more skeptical about this and less likely to believe it. I know there over the next couple of weeks, we're going to hear a lot of excuses and a lot of different things, but ultimately, it's just hard to believe that Canelo could be this foolish and his team could be this incompetent to take something with a tainted meat. All right, let me ask you this about Golovkin and his stance on this. I brought this up with Kevin last week, and I'll bring it up with you. I've covered Golovkin for a long time. He's always been, you know, the good boy, you know, the very kind of bright-eyed optimist, just wants to have all the big fights. This was the first time that I've ever heard him really upset. And maybe it's the positive test. Maybe it's everything to do with chasing Canelo and having to acquiesce to everything that Canelo and his team have asked for in these negotiations. But the snapping of Golovkin over the last couple of weeks, what have you made of that?
I think it was everything just boiling over, Chris. You know, between he won the first fight. You know, I think everyone who knows what they're watching and doesn't have an agenda would say that he won the first fight, right? So he has to live with that for, you know, 5 or 6 months. It obviously affects his purse for the rematch, because technically he didn't win the fight. And he felt like he was mistreated by Nevada officials, not only in the scoring of the fight, but maybe some other things that led up to the fight that he wasn't pleased with. So he feels like the deck is stacked against him. And now the guy is potentially cheating, and his mind clearly is cheating. He snapped, you know, he finally snapped. And look, we had asked for how long, Chris? You and I have covered Gennady Golovkin the entire time that he's been fighting in America, yeah. Right? How many times did we ask, hey, we understand that he speaks English. It's great that he's trying to learn the language and converse with us in what is not his native language. But please let him speak in Russian and have it translated, because we'll get better answers. We'll get more genuine answers out of him if he does that. Well, that's what he did last week when he was very upset. And look what happened. I mean, he went, mm-hmm. I mean, as you said, he went napalm. I mean, some of the stuff was a little overboard, honestly, Chris. I mean, you know, he compared the judges and the officials in Nevada to terrorists. I mean, that's way over the top and unnecessary. But
dragged Oscar into it too.
Dragged Oscar into it. Exactly. I mean, you know, so he went overboard, like I said. But at least we're getting some genuine raw stuff from Gennady Golovkin, because honestly, for the last 3 or 4 years, it's been the same stock answers, the same 6 or 7 answers. Sometimes not even actually answering your questions. He's just going to say what he's going to say no matter what you ask him. So he did endear himself to a lot of people by, you know, by having this persona, and, you know, he's very easy to deal with. He's a pleasant person for us to deal with, but you're not getting a lot out of him here. Unfortunately, neither you nor I were there, but boy, did they get a lot out of him that day.
Yeah, I tell you, a couple of years ago, I went up to Big Bear with a translator because I was doing a profile on him for Sports Illustrated. And, you know, you're right. If you sit and talk to him, he tries, but it's just he goes back to kind of the same cliches and same words that he knows. But if you, you know, get a translator with him and his brother too, these guys have lived an unbelievable lives. You know, they can be really articulate and talk about that. And that was an example of it, with the comments made about Canelo. All right. So we'll see what happens with that. The Nevada Commission, they'll have to figure something out next month. All right. The big fight this weekend, Anthony Joshua, unified heavyweight champion, Joseph Parker. He has a piece of the heavyweight title. They're fighting over in the UK. This is a pretty big fight. I mean, whatever you think of Joseph Parker, a heavyweight unification fight is a big deal, no matter where it takes place. Now, when you look at this fight, do you see a clear favorite here? I mean, Joshua has to be favored because of his track record compared to Parker's, but yeah, you know, what do you make of Parker, and how much of a chance do you give him in this fight?
I don't know that Anthony Joshua should necessarily be an 8 or 9 to 1 favorite, but he's clearly a favorite here, Chris. He's the guy who's walked through the fire against Vladimir Klitschko, got off the deck, you know, knocked out Vladimir Klitschko in his career-defining fight. However old Vladimir was and however long of a layoff he was coming off of entering that fight, that was very impressive what Anthony Joshua did. Joseph Parker has not done anything resembling that in his 5.5 years as a pro boxer, right? In his three title fights, in fact, he's won 2 of those fights by majority decision. He did not look particularly good against Andy Ruiz when he won the vacant title in December of 2016. He beat one of his former sparring partners in what was considered a dull fight that he should have won by knockout. There are people that think maybe Huey Fury deserved a draw in their last fight. He was far from dominant in that fight, won another majority decision. So this is a guy whose power hasn't translated at the championship level. It did when he was on his way up and he built his knockout record up, but it hasn't since he's fought better fighters. And none of these guys are going to be confused for Anthony Joshua. So I think when he gets in the ring with Joshua, with, you know, almost 80,000 people, all of whom are going to be rooting for Joshua, basically outside of Joseph Parker's family, you know, I can't see him pulling this off. And there's nothing that he's done in his career that would lead you to believe that he pulls this off. I mean, he's a top 5 or 6 heavyweight for sure. But is he equipped to go there and do this on Saturday night? I don't think so. But just one thing, Chris, that I will mm-hmm. that I say could be a little bit of a an interesting factor going into the fight is that he did have surgery on both of his elbows back in December. They say that affected him greatly in his previous three or four fights, and that he's, you know, he's able to do much more now. We won't know that until Saturday, how much of an impact that had on him, but I think that's interesting that he did have those two surgeries. I guess it was about 4 months ago now, and they say it's been a, you know, it's made him train better and he feels much more confident, and we'll see how that translates in the fight.
Yeah, I saw Joseph Parker fight back in 2014 when he was fighting on NBC, and I was impressed. I mean, I thought he had a great skill set. He clearly had a great jaw. I thought there was a rising star in him, and there was, really, right up until the point where he fought for and won his title. And really, since then, he's been incredibly unimpressive. He beats Andy Ruiz in a life-and-death fight with Ruiz that could have gone either way. And his next couple of defenses, just not much. The Fury fight, like you said, I didn't think a heck of a lot of. And, you know, he's walking into enemy territory here. And he's going to be doing something in front of a crowd that he's never experienced before. And everything I hear from Parker's side, most of it, Keith, is that he can take Joshua's punch. I know they're saying he can also knock Joshua out, but I don't feel, when I read the comments and I watch some of the clips on YouTube, I don't sense the same conviction from them that they can knock Joshua out. So is he going to be able to outbox Joshua and win a decision in the UK? Is he going to be able to stand there and take some of these big shots? I just don't see it. Maybe I'm wrong, but his track record over his last three fights, really the Dmitrenko fight was his last impressive showing when he knocked out a much bigger opponent. But Ruiz is next to, these are not hallmarks of a fighter that I think is building momentum towards the biggest fight of his career. So I think he gets stopped. And I think it happens, you know, middle of the fight, sixth, seventh round.
Wow, that would be a real feather in Anthony Joshua's cap.
It would,
because
yeah.
As you said, Chris, the one thing that Joseph Parker has done throughout his career is shown a very good chin. Now, he hasn't fought, you know, Anthony Joshua and Deontay Wilder are the two biggest punchers in the heavyweight division. He hasn't fought someone quite like that yet. But if Joshua is able to get him out of there that quickly, I mean, that would be very impressive. You know, I honestly could see the fight going the distance also because Joseph Parker has shown such a good chin, mm-hmm. and he can box. You know, he's a pretty good, you know, he's a pretty good boxer for a 6'4".
A very good boxer, yeah.
You know, and he might, I don't know exactly what his weight is going to be. It looks like he's slimmer, so maybe he's 235, between 230 and 235 in the fight. So, you know, maybe he's able to keep Joshua off him long enough to go the distance. They're confident that they can win a decision in Wales more than anything because they just won a decision in England, which caused the fighter from England, Huey Fury, to file a protest with the WBO, which they dismissed. But so he's already won a decision in the UK. Now, of course, that was a much lower profile fight. There wasn't nearly as much at stake, but there are judges from New Zealand, England and the United States in this fight, so they feel like they're going to get a fair shake on the cards. They feel like Joseph Parker is the more diverse, complete boxer. And look, there are a lot of questions about Anthony Joshua's chin. You know, there's no shame in getting knocked down by Vladimir Klitschko, of course, but Chris, how many of these stories have we heard that he's been down in the gym so many times, mm-hmm. and he's been knocked out as an amateur and stuff that we don't have any footage of, and it's all just hearsay and speculation. But you know, maybe Joseph Parker clips him, and we're telling a very different story next week than we think we're telling.
Now, the outcome of this fight is obviously relevant, but I think everybody's wants to know what's going to happen after this fight, particularly if Joshua comes out the winner. We learned this week that Deontay Wilder is not going to be ringside for this fight. Some kind of beef about him not being allowed in the ring, and that to me, Keith, you know, seems like the last hope that we had of Wilder Joshua taking place in 2018, that's gone. These two sides, they don't seem interested in having a serious conversation at this point. The fighters, at least Deontay Wilder certainly seems interested, but there's all the back and forth between Shelley Finkel and Eddie Hearn. And I don't know about you, but I've basically given up on the hope that Wilder Joshua takes place this year.
I have too, Chris, and I don't blame Deontay Wilder for not making the trip this week. If he was able to go there and call the fight, you know, and be a guest commentator for Sky Sports and get into the ring and cause some kind of, you know, not a fight, obviously, but, you know, have some kind of confrontation with Joshua, yeah. that would at least lead people to believe to some degree that they're going to fight next, then it's worth the trip for him. If he's going to go over there and they're going to tell him, as they've already said, Joshua has said it publicly, Eddie Hearn also has said it, that they were not going to allow him to get in the ring if Joshua beats Parker and come in there and do like a, you know, we could all do without the WWE type of stuff, but not allow him to even enter the ring, And then you're going to have him sitting ringside, and you know what they're going to do. Then they're going to have Dillian White approach Wilder and call out Wilder for a fight that hasn't been mandated yet by the WBC, but could
and
be.
And won't be, by the way, because the WBC, from what I heard, the fact that Wilder took a Stavern fight that he didn't want to take, the WBC is going to back off for a while.
It could be. So he can get an optional defense, and he might wind up fighting Dominic Brazil in between. Because if the WBC, the other thing obviously is if the WBC calls an elimination match and makes Dillian White earn that mandatory spot, he would have to fight Dominic Brazil unless Brazil fights Wilder in an optional defense, because Brazil is ranked number two by the WBC. But outside of that, Deontay Wilder didn't want to be put in a position where he's going there looking for the what's probably the biggest fight, or it is the biggest fight in boxing that hasn't been made thus far, and then he's stuck arguing with Dillian White at ringside and banned from ringside. It's not; it wouldn't be a good look for him. He would almost feel like he was begging to even have a face-to-face confrontation with Anthony Joshua, much less a fight. So I understand why he's not going. You know, he's going to make the rounds a little bit, doing some TV and radio the next couple of days and give his take on the whole thing. But, you know, I get it why he's not going. It would have been good to see him there and to see them actually go face-to-face, assuming that Joshua beats Parker. But I understand why he's not going.
What do you make of Dillian White, by the way? Wins a big fight. Not a big fight. I mean, I thought it was going to be a decent fight, but then Lucas Brown didn't look like he was in any kind of shape when he got into the ring and had his face carved up in the early rounds. But it was a knockout of the year candidate because of how Lucas Brown went down and out on that left hand. I mean, are you a White guy? Do you think he's – what kind of contender is he?
Look, Lucas Brown made him look like a combination of Muhammad Ali and Mike Tyson the other day. It was you know, Lucas Brown's a tough guy and everything, but he was basically a punching bag for most of that fight, unfortunately. And thankfully, he's okay because that was really a vicious knockout at the end of that fight.
I've never seen a fighter get oxygen after a fight like that. I mean, I'm sure it happens.
I think they were really worried, Chris. I mean, the way he went face down, and he was unconscious for a few seconds there for sure.
That's so, Paul Williams stuff.
Yeah. Exactly. No, and so thankfully, he's okay, and you know, maybe he'll retire or whatever. But as far as Dillian White, it's kind of – he's not that good. He's probably not as bad as he was against Robert Hellenius in a fight that he won pretty easily on the cards, but just didn't do much in that. You know, he just didn't, he wasn't impressive in that fight. And that was partially due to Hellenius not engaging him too, but he got hurt early in that fight. You know, that wasn't a good, particularly good performance from him. The Derek Chisora fight, you know, at this point, I don't know if Derek Chisora is even a top 15 heavyweight anymore, but that was a life and death type of fight for Dillian White. So he's probably somewhere in between. But really all he is for Eddie Hearn, for the most part, is an obstacle to put in Deontay Wilder's way so he doesn't get to Anthony Joshua yet. So I get why Eddie Hearn keeps pushing the fight. Is it a fight that the public really wants to see? You know, maybe in England they do because, you know, they love their boxing over there clearly, so maybe they would like to see White fight him. But I think even they all would like to see Joshua fight Wilder first. So, you know, Dillian White's probably, you know, a lower portion of the top 10 in heavyweights, but he's not nearly as good as he looked on Saturday.
Yeah, I agree with you on the Dillian White kind of just being the way Eddie Hearn can just put him in front. So you got to fight White first. You got to fight White first. Then he throws that money out there and says $4 million for that fight. So I don't need to see Dillian White fight. I think Wilder would drop him unless he wants to like go over there and like I thought it was a good idea. You know, before he made the Ortiz fight, to go over there and fight White and you know, just have two guys in the UK, you know, fighting back to back, and then you could build towards a summer fight. But once that came off the table, I just don't care. I don't care about Brazil either. Like, he's gonna flatten Brazil.
No, Chris, I'll say this though, if just for argument's sake, Eddie Hearn says he's offered $4 million thus far for Wilder to fight Dillian White. That's around twice as much as they made to fight Luis Ortiz, which is, you know, clearly was a more dangerous fight. He almost got knocked out in the fight, right? So now, just for argument's sake, say he offers him between $5 and $6 million to go over there and fight him. At some point, it's too much money to turn down, particularly for a fight that he might not perceive as dangerous. Now, I'm not saying Dillian White has no chance in the fight because the guy can punch a little bit. He's not a bad boxer, but he would be a pretty big underdog in the fight. But if you're Wilder and you can go over there and make between $5 and $6 million, why wouldn't you do it?
Yeah.
Especially if you know there's no chance that you're getting Joshua next, and you might have to fight Dominic Brazil next for at least half of that.
Yeah.
At most half of that, right? I mean, so at some point it becomes about money. You know, that's why they're doing this ultimately, to provide for their families long term. So, you know, that's a lot of money.
Yeah, I agree with you. Well, we'll see what happens. Big weekend coming up in the heavyweight division. Keith, always appreciate you coming in studio, man. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks, Chris. I appreciate it, man.
All right, joining me on the podcast right now, middleweight contender Jason Quigley, fighting in my backyard here in the Boston, Massachusetts area. Welcome back. Not your first time in Massachusetts, but welcome back to Massachusetts.
Without a doubt, you know, I think any Irishman that comes here feels right at home, and that's exactly the way that I've been feeling since I came here. You know, me and my coach, Dominic Ingle, we flew in on Sunday, and just feels like I'm fighting back at home.
Yeah, I've said that to the when Michael Conlon signed over, I said to the top ranked guys, I'm like, why don't you put him in the Boston area? There's a lot of Irish there. They're like, yeah, we'll get there, but there really is a good Irish fan base here. That you were in Plymouth, I think, a few fights ago, yes. And now you're here, and they turn out here. The Irish turn out pretty good for fighters.
Yeah, without a doubt. Like, it's as I said, you know, it's something special, and I think it's recognized all over the world. The support the Irish have, you know, no matter where we go in the world, there's an Irish bar somewhere, there's an Irish pub somewhere, you know, and the people always turn out, and it's just unbelievable. Like, and the support now on Saturday night's going to be amazing. You know, I've got a lot of ones flying in from Ireland for this fight. I've got a lot of ones coming down from New York, Canada, and obviously then the load of ones that's here in Boston as it is, it's going to be a special night.
So what, you know, growing up in Ireland the way you did, what was the boxing scene like out there? What got you into the sport and what pushed you in that direction?
To be honest, at the stage I was growing up in boxing, it was mainly amateur boxing. It was the likes of Andy Lee and everything like that, because I was a wee bit after the Barry McGuigan, Steve Collins, all that kind of time.
You're a little younger.
A little younger, just yeah. A little, yeah. But for me, it was the likes of Andy Lee, and it was the likes of all these fighters, you know, that were Kenny Egan and the lads that were going on winning world European, representing Ireland at Olympics, everything like that there. And that was the kind of Irish boxing scene that I grew up in, and that's, I think, why, you know, the Olympics and world championships and everything like that became a goal of mine, because that's what was there in front of me.
Mm-hmm. And did you ever, I mean, at that point, you know, it's boxing, mixed martial arts is mixed in there well. Did you ever experiment with mixed martial arts?
No, I didn't. And it's another thing that kind of came after my time, after I got into boxing. You know, I was into boxing and, you know, I loved the sport and I was well established as a boxer by the time the UFC and everything like that came around. But, you know, things maybe would have been different if I was younger. Maybe I would be in the UFC now and not the boxing, but I'm not too sure if I would. You know, I'm a big boxing fan as well. I love the sport and, you know, I'm grateful for the position that I'm in.
Who were the guys that you looked up to? You mentioned Andy Lee as a name that was there coming up in the amateur ranks there. But who were some other guys that you kind of, you know, I don't say idolized, but looked up to as boxers?
Yeah, well, look, of course, at the end of the day, you have the likes of Muhammad Ali and you have the likes of Floyd Mayweather. But for me, it was actually one of the main reasons that I got into boxing was, I remember sitting up late one night with my father to watch Marco Antonio Barrera fight Prince and Nassim. And
so you liked a good war in the
ring. Yeah, exactly. And it was something about that fight that just caught my attention. It was the first time in my life that I ever got goosebumps. I remember watching it. I could see the pride and the passion in Barrera and the way that he just showed Prince no respect and everything like that there. And he just got on with the job and put his head down and went to work. And that was one of the first fights that I've ever really watched, one of the first fights that I've ever really got excited about. And I just knew then that it lit something inside me that I want to give this a go.
Is there a fighting style that you sort of patterned yours after? I mean, Barrera fought, he was straight ahead. He was, He was, I'm going to knock you out or I'm going to die trying out there.
Exactly, you know, and I think that's the typical style, Mexican style, mm-hmm. you know. But, you know, as an amateur growing up, I was very a good mover, hand speed, technically a good fighter. You know, and obviously then as I turned professional, I was in Los Angeles for 3.5 years out there. So I kind of adapted and changed myself to a more Mexican style fighter, which isn't me. Mm-hmm. But now looking back, I'm tapped in now more to my boxing capabilities, my skills, my movement, my hand speed, smarter boxing. But at the end of the day, I know if I need to pull it out of the bag and I need to go full steam ahead, I can knuckle down and I can let them go as well.
As a young fighter trying to make your mark, do you feel the, maybe it's not pressure, but do you feel like you have to be an entertainer too in the ring? Like you have an opportunity coming up, not just fighting in the Boston area, but fighting on ESPN, which is, you know, more important for your career. Do you feel that in the back of your head as you're preparing for a fight that, you know, not only do I want to win, but I want to make that kind of statement that gets remembered after the fight and the days following?
Of course, you know, that's we're like gladiators, you know, in the Coliseum. We want to hear the crowd roar our name. We want to hear them chant for us. And, you know, at the end of the day, though, those are the things that we can't control. Mm-hmm. You know, the things that we can control is our performances. And, you know, the type of person that I am, I know how skillful I am. I know how talented I am. I know how entertaining I am as well. And all I have to concentrate on is getting into that ring, performing to the best I can, giving it my best once I step through those ropes. And once I do that, I know everything else outside it's going to fall into place. Mm. The crowd will go wild. ESPN will love it. People viewing in is going to love it. And, you know, it'll all fall together. But at the end of the day, you know, I learned that growing up. There was a stage that all I wanted to do was please the crowd and please the people that came to watch me and different things like that. But now I understand that it's all about me getting in there and performing and doing what I have to do and letting everything else fall into place.
You had a chance, if I'm getting this right, in 2016 you could have fought for the Irish Olympic team. Is that right?
Yeah.
You passed on that opportunity. Why did you go a different direction?
To be honest, the reason that I went that different direction was I won European gold medal, world silver medal, and I was ranked number one as an amateur fighter in the world. So obviously I had the attention of all the big dogs out there, Golden Boy, Top Rank, everything like that. And, you know, the offers were coming in, and as I've said there previously, the reason I got into boxing was whenever I saw Barrera and Prince Nassim fight, and the whole hype about the fight, the world titles, everything like that. That was the fire that I had deep down inside me as a kid. Mm-hmm. Olympic Games, World Championships, amateur boxing only became something that I wanted to achieve whenever it was there in front of me and I seen, oh, I can achieve this. Mm-hmm. But the real desire and the real passion for me was to be world professional champion. And it just was an offer then that I couldn't turn down, that Golden Boy gave me. And no regrets looking back now, you know what I mean? The way that amateur boxing going recently, it maybe just isn't hitting the peak that it used to have. Mm-hmm. And professional boxing is absolutely booming. Mm-hmm.
The UK boxing scene is huge, you know, as big, if not bigger, than what it is in the United States. Why Golden Boy, and you've fought, I think, all of your pro fights here in the U.S., why go that direction as opposed to maybe looking at a European promoter?
Well, as I say, you know, Golden Boy gave me an offer I couldn't really reject.
That's what it comes down to, yeah, right? You know, get a real offer, yeah.
Exactly, because I was getting very well looked after on the national team as well. I was getting paid well. I was getting looked after well. So I wasn't just going to turn professional just to say I've turned professional for peanuts, like, you know what I mean? I was going to make sure that it was a sensible move in every aspect, you know, inside and outside of boxing, and it was. But back then, and it's not long ago, 3.5 years ago, you know, professional boxing is, and maybe Los Angeles, California was the capital of professional boxing, you know, and the Las Vegas and the LA, all the great fighters have fought there, came from there. you know, everything about it was a buzz, and that's obviously where Golden Boy was. That's where my management team, Shear Sports, is. So it just was maybe like that's the place to be. So we did that. We made that move, and we made the move to Los Angeles, and I lived there for 3.5 years, and I served my apprenticeship, as you could say, and I did what I had to do. You know, I fought my pro debut in the MGM Grand in Las Vegas on the Canelo Lara undercard, and you know, all these amazing experiences that money can't buy are all in the bank now. They're all in the tank there when I need them. And you know, I broke my hand in my last fight, and people are going to say to me, you know, oh, it was such a terrible thing. It was this, that, whatever. But honestly, it was one of the best things that ever happened to me, because things just weren't fitting the bill for me in LA. I wasn't, you know, I'm an Irish man. You know, I'll fit in Boston and New York and places like that, but the Hollywood Hills and Santa Monica and Venice Beach, it just didn't click for me. Of course, the first year and a half was amazing. It was all like a dream, kind of, you know. But once the novelty wore off, you know, I came back to my roots, and I felt, you know, this just isn't fitting the bill for me. And I made the move back over to Sheffield to the famous Ingle camp under the watchful eye now of Dominic Ingle. And, you know, I couldn't be happier. And that is the God's honest truth. You know, I'm such a happy fighter now, and I'm so looking forward to getting back into the ring on Saturday night.
So you said a bunch of stuff there. One thing I want to follow up on is the, you know, going over to your new camp there, what's the difference? I mean, besides the change in location, I mean, what's different about training back overseas?
Well, the weather's a lot better in Sheffield.
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah.
No, look, it was like going back home again. You know, Los Angeles, and you're obviously American. People will even say that California is a different country to America. You know, that's what a lot of people have said to me when I was out there. They're like, "Oh, this isn't even America. This is a country of its own, kind of." And I was like, "What are they on about? Do I not know something here?" But as time went on, I realized that and I understood that. And you know, it just felt like I went back to my roots again. You know, Los Angeles has the weather, the time difference, the people's different, the food's different, the culture, everything is so different. It's not just a slight change. Mm-hmm. It was just a complete flip over to what I was used to. And, you know, it just didn't fit. It didn't work for me. It wasn't pulling the strings, as you could say. And I had to get back to Sheffield. I had to get back to somewhere closer to home, and you know, just couldn't be happier with the move now.
What's it done for you? Do you feel like you're in better shape? Do you feel like you're sharper mentally? I mean, tell me about the move has done for you.
Look, I will be honest with you. I wasn't very happy in Los Angeles. It was very lonely, depressing at times. You know, I didn't have my family, friends, people around me, and it was difficult. But now, just even saying it, I've put a smile on my face, you know, thinking of the change. I'm just so much happier because I'm so close to home. I'm a 50 minute flight away from my hometown. When I leave my house in Sheffield, I get to my house in Ireland. It's a 4-hour round trip. It's not 11-hour trip, 8-hour time difference, a week of jet lag. You know, it's just so much easier. And it's so much more convenient, and it just has made me a happier person mentally. And I think a lot of people will agree with me. When you're happy mentally, physically it shows.
Was Golden Boy in favor of it? Was your training staff in favor? Because sometimes, and I'll use, you know, Felix Verdejo as an example, when you are close to home, it's not always a good thing. Sometimes you have to branch out and get out of your comfort zone. Were people around you in favor of you going back to the UK?
I think that's a thing that, you know, that I'm unique in a way, because a lot of fighters need to be in training camps. A lot of fighters need to be away from home. They need to be kind of locked away from all the distractions and everything like that. But for me, you know, I'm such a disciplined person. I don't drink. I don't smoke. I don't live these hectic lifestyles. I'm very down to earth.
An Irish guy doesn't drink. That's
exactly. I mean, and this is the thing that
You're a unicorn. That's the first I've ever first I've ever met. First Irishman.
The trouble that I had proven to people that I was Irish whenever I told them I didn't drink was crazy. But yeah, you know, that's the type of me, you know. Just I'm very disciplined, you know. I still love to go out and party and everything like that, but at certain times. Mm-hmm. But I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't abuse my body in any way. And that's the thing about me. My family, my partner, my people around me, those are my fuel. Those are my alcohol. Those are my drugs. You know what I mean? And those are the people that drive me on. And to have them around me, that's what's important to me. And that has made me happy in my heart, in my head, every way. And that's why that my whole team around me, Golden Boy Promotions, you know, my management, Shear Sports, they were 100% behind me because they've had 3.5 years with me. I had a meeting with Golden Boy halfway through my rehab and, you know, getting over the injury. And I walked in and they looked at me and I was like, am I wearing a mask or something, or what's going on here? And they're like, you're in great shape. And I says, ah, yeah, you know, keeping myself in good nick, because once you give me the call, I'm ready to go. Once my hand's ready. And he goes, Jason, you're in better shape than most active fighters, you know. And that's just who I am. You know, I stay in shape because I enjoy it and I feel good about myself when I'm in shape, and I feel good training and eating good and everything like that. Don't get me wrong. You know, when I'm not in camp and I don't have a fight, I love going for a Chinese, and I love going for an Indian or a fish and chip or something like that. You know, everything in moderation. But, you know, you have to enjoy life as well. And, you know, my team was 110% behind me, and it was, I can't fault anything.
Eric Gomez has called you the best prospect in Golden Boy's stable in the past, and you were treated accordingly early in your career. You mentioned making your debut on the Canelo Lara fight. You fought in a whole bunch of really high profile undercards. What were those experiences like for you? To, you know, you're probably not fighting in front of a lot of people at that moment in that, but to be on those big events. What was the coolest part of all that?
That's exactly what I was just going to say to you. I remember, you know, my first pro debut, MGM Grand. You know, it flashed back to the first fight that I've ever really properly watched, Barrera and Hamed. And I remember, you know, the cameras be backstage and they watch them walking through the tunnel before they come out for their main entrance. And I remember seeing Barrera coming in the MGM Lion signpost up on the wall. And I was walking out and I seen it at the corner of my eye. I was like, geez, that's it. Like, you know what I mean? And next thing the curtains opened and there was like 20 people in the stands, you know what I mean? It was a crazy mixed emotions, but it was like these are the type of experiences that I think are going to stand by me when my shot arrives to fighting for world titles at that high level. I'm not going to be one of these fighters that come in to fight the champion and be blinded by the bright lights and by the... I've done it all. I've been there. I've walked in with Canelo to the grand arrivals, to the media workouts, to the press conferences, to the weigh-ins. I have done it all. I know what it's all about, and I've experienced it. And it's not going to blind me. It's not going to, you know, make me nervous or nothing like that. I'm going to take it all in my stride. And this is the experience that you cannot buy. And this is why I'm so grateful for those 3.5 years that I've had.
One of the, I would assume, benefits of being with Golden Boy is you have, you know, access to a De La Hoya and access maybe to a Bernard Hopkins as, you know, one of the great middleweights in boxing history. With Hopkins in particular, have you ever had any conversations with him just about boxing and as you're trying to develop, you know, what you might have learned from him?
Yeah, you know, Bernard is like, what do you call those kind of stories that you be told? It's like a riddle, mm-hmm. You know, so Bernard's, when you're talking to him, it's like he's reading out riddles to you. He doesn't tell you things, but he makes you think about things, which I really enjoy and I really liked, you know. And Bernard's always like, you tell me any other promotional group out there or any other people involved in boxing that have been to the heights, have been to the lows, and know exactly what boxing's all about. And the likes of Oscar De La Hoya, and Bernard Hopkins. Who else has a promoter with that kind of experience? You cannot buy that experience either. And to have a promoter that understands a fighter, that's priceless. Because there's so many promoters out there that just know boxing as a business. And of course, don't get me wrong, it is a business. And yes, Oscar and Bernard have employed me and they're the bosses. And at the end of the day, when it comes down to it, it's business. But at least they understand how a fighter is happy when a fighter needs this, that, and everything else. They understand it. They have been through it and they know how to treat fighters. And that's mainly the main reason I went to Golden Boy.
Of course, when you talk to Bernard, you have to clear like an hour out of your schedule
exactly.
to hear a story. I've had many of those conversations with Bernard yeah. that you think it's going to be 5 minutes, it turns into 45 very, very quickly. Your last fight against Glenn Tapia, going into it, looked at it as a step up in competition for you. Tapia, an experienced guy. You talked about breaking your hand in that fight. Just was that the first time in a fight that you've had to deal with that type of adversity?
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, I never felt or had an injury like that in a fight or going into a fight. You know, it was something that when it happened, I was like, right, this doesn't need to happen right now. It was one of those things that it was my first major. Well, I had a step up with James De La Rosa as well and Jorge Melendez in two previous fights before that. But Glenn Tapia was the more popular name, and it was for the NABF middleweight title. It was live on ESPN, main event, my first sold-out arena in California, and it was like, when it happened, okay, this doesn't have to happen right now, but it did, and this is the sport that we're in. But, you know, the way that I look back on it now, and I was able to deal with the situation that came up, not only deal with it, but come out victorious at the end, because Glenn Tapia is a tough fighter and fighting him with one hand makes him a little bit tougher. You know what I mean? So I'm obviously not happy with the performance, but when I take into consideration I was 50% of the fighter, you get into a fight with two hands, you're 100%. You get in with one hand, you're only 50% of the fighter. So for me, I'm happy with the performance, the way that I adapted, the way that I changed, and came through and got the victory.
Obviously, coming off an injury, you want to, you know, get back into a rhythm as quickly as possible. But when you look at your career and how soon you'll be ready for that world title shot, what do you think? I mean, obviously your promoter might think one thing, but what do you think about your when you're ready for that opportunity?
Yeah, and another, you know, this time next year, I hope to be right in line for world title eliminator or a world title shot. You know, this year now is for me to really make my mark. To really, you know, put my name up there with the best fighters in the world, and to let everybody know that I'm coming for the titles, because this now is my time. And, you know, I've had that year off to think about everything, to understand how precious your limbs are, you know, to understand that we're not all invincible, and, you know, to understand life mainly. And you know, now I understand exactly a lot more than I did before. You know, I feel as if I've matured 10 years in the last year because of everything that has happened. And now I understand where I'm at, and I'm ready to state my authority, to state my name, and to make a lot of noise this year in the middleweight division.
Were you at the first Canelo-Golovkin fight in September?
I was at it, yep.
What, I mean, as looking at those guys who are the top, the middleweight, division, when you watch them fight, does it give you any kind of sense of where you are and how far you have to go to kind of get to that level? Because that's obviously the dream, to fight, yeah. You know, to be the number one middleweight fighting other number one middleweight. Does that give you any kind of context there of how far you have to go?
To be honest, every time I fight them, I feel like turning around, or not every time I fight them, every time that you probably know where this answer is going now after me saying that, but you know, every time I watch that fight, watch these world champions and everything like that, I just feel like getting into the gym, starting training camp and getting ready for one of them, you know. But as I says, in the last year I have learned so much and I've matured so much, and I understand that it takes time, it takes patience, and it takes preparation. And for me, I know I'm ready for these guys. I know what I have what it takes to beat these guys. But my time isn't now, but it's coming. And when it does come, I will be 100% ready to lift those titles.
Have you had an opportunity to spar with you know, significant middleweight, significant fighters?
Yeah, I've sparred with the likes of David Lemieux. I've sparred with the likes of Zerto Ramirez, super middleweight world champion, Benavidez, super middleweight world champion. You know, I've sparred with some amazing fighters. Shane Mosley, I've sparred with him. You know, I've sparred with a lot of great fighters.
Do you learn stuff in sparring? I mean, is that like an educational experience for a young fighter?
You know, there's a lot of people out there that I think mix sparring and fighting, and they don't understand that, you know, sparring's about getting in there, learning, working on things, figuring people out, trying different things. And that's what I do every time I get into spar, whether I'm sparring a guy that's an amateur, whether I'm sparring a former world champion or a world champion, whatever. I just get in there to learn, to work on things, to see what they're good at, to see what they're not good at, to try and pick up on them, different things like that. And every spar that I get into, you know, I'm reading my opponents and I'm reading my sparring partners to, obviously, the people that I could possibly be fighting. But in general, I just read them and try to pick chinks in their armory and work on that, because, you know, every fighter is different, but at the end of the day, every fighter is a jab, every fighter is a right hand, and if you can master, you know, disguising them and countering with them, you do that, and that's what I do. You know, I've learned every spar that I get into, I learn a lot.
It's not going to happen this year, it probably won't happen next year, but let's say 2020, you and Canelo are kind of in that same sort of age bracket there, and you're both represented by Golden Boy. I mean, again, it's a way down the line, but do you think about that, you know, maybe there's, you know, as you watch Canelo, that maybe some point, if he's still a middleweight, which probably he'll be in that term, and you are, that's a fight that could be kind of your dream scenario.
Of course, like, I'm the type of fighter, though, that I don't fixate myself on any individual and say, oh, I want to fight them, or can't wait to the day I fight that person, because boxing's so unpredictable. I know when my time arrives that I'm going to fight for the world title. But who's to say that Canelo's going to be champion? Who's to say Golovkin's going to be champion? Who's to say that these guys are still even going to be fighting? You know, this is the thing about it. Boxing's so unpredictable that I just concentrate on myself. I concentrate on my fight now on Saturday night, and that's my world title fight. Because I know I get in there, perform well, get the victory, move on to the next one. I'm another step closer. And that's exactly the way I do it. But of course, I'm a fighter. I watch these fights, and I know in the back of my head it's a big possibility. I want to be world champion. Canelo is the world. Canelo, well, him and Golovkin are split now in the middle between the belts and everything like that. Golovkin still has them, but, you know, it's all on the line now, May 5th again. So, of course, I know that it's a possibility, and I do look at them, and I look at these champions and say, what do they have different than me? What do they do that makes them world champion? And when I look at it, you know, there's nothing stands out. Do you know what I mean? They're just talented fighters that work hard. And you'll find that with a lot of people, you know, a lot of world champions, that they're not made from, they come from Mars or somewhere. They're human beings. Everyone's beatable. Everyone makes mistakes. And it's just about being 100% prepared once your time comes.
Are you competitive with other fighters from Ireland that are right around your age bracket? A Michael Conlan, for example. Do you watch what they're doing?
Yeah, I think me and Michael's good friends. You know, we get on great together. We were obviously in the same camp together in Los Angeles and everything, and we grew up together on the national team, being on holidays together. But the thing that is about it, we all have friendly competition. You know what I mean? And obviously, we'll never end up fighting unless Michael turns into a Ricky Hatton or something. But, you know, we have a friendly competition going on. Like, I go and win a world title, Michael's going to want to go and win a world title and say that he's the best world champion, and I want to be the best world champion. But it's all friendly. It's all friendly competition. You know what I mean? You have the likes of Carol Frampton there. You know, these people are doing great things for Irish boxing, and they're putting Irish boxing on the map. But we all want to better ourselves. But we don't want to do it because we dislike each other. We want to do it because it's just competition. We're fighters. That's what we do. And it's only positive that we're like that, because we'll always keep trying to better each other and just make boxing even better.
Do you see yourself, you know, kind of making a certain U.S. city a home base? I mean, Conlon is kind of, whenever he's had the opportunity, fight in New York, fight at the Garden. You're here in the Massachusetts area. I think it'd be great if somebody built themselves and could sell out the Boston Garden at some point. But do you see yourself like looking at a certain part of the country as kind of being where you want to be, you know, have at least like one fight a year or two fights a year, whatever it is?
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, I have spoke to my management team, promotional team, Golden Boy, Sheer Sports, and I've told them, you know, I want to fight on the East Coast, whether it's New York, whether it's Boston, but all I have been getting is great feedback from Boston, and I'm being drawn to Boston more. And yes, this is where I want to make my home base, you know what I mean? In the States, you know, my home base is always going to be Ireland, but in the States, I want to make my home base here in Boston, and I want to sell out the Boston Garden, and I want to, you know, get it full of Irish, light it up green, and, you know, make it eventful. Like, make it, I don't want to just put on a boxing show, I want to put on an event. I want people, Quigley's fighting in 2 months' time, ringing their boss, I'm not going to be in that way. You know what I mean? That's what I want. I want to make it exciting for the Irish fans and my boxing fans as well.
Yeah, Ricky Hatton fought here years back and did really well. Yeah, like he fought, I forget who it was, but it was a good event. He fought at the Garden,
yeah.
Big crowd. But for whatever reason, they don't do a lot of events. But and Irish, like, you have given almost the perfect last name too for, it's like, Quigley's fighting, let's
yeah,
go. And,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
Let's go to the Garden and fight and pick it up.
Yeah, you know, like that's what I mean. It's exciting. And, you know, obviously I fought in Plymouth. I'm fighting here now in Quincy, and who knows, maybe the Garden will be filled up shortly here in Boston, and we'll have the best fans in the world screaming our names.
Before I let you go, what do you know about your opponent coming up? It is kind of coming off a layoff, off the hand injury. What do you know about your opponent? What are you thinking for this fight?
This is, you know, a lot of people will take a kind of a stiff opponent and their fight back and try and get him out of there in a few rounds, things like that. But, you know, I'm coming back now. I want a good competitive fight, and Daniel Rosario is going to bring that to the table because, you know, he's a tough Puerto Rican. He's got 14 fights with 11 wins, 3 losses, but 10 of his wins have come by way of knockout. So he's a tough, he's hard, he punches hard, and he's going to be in there to win. But look, at this stage of my career now, I don't care who they put in through the ropes for me, because whoever it is, they're in there to stop me from getting what I want to get. And I've been through too much. I've sacrificed too much. I have worked too hard. And, you know, I'm too talented to let these guys get in my way. So Saturday night comes, I'm scheduled to fight Rosario, whether he's there or they pull King Kong in on Saturday night. I don't care who it is. I'm getting in there to do a job, get the performance, put on a great show for the fans here in Boston, and to move on to the next one and keep climbing that ladder.
Well, Jason, good luck on Saturday. ESPN2, Daniel Rosario fighting in Quincy, Mass. If you can't see it on TV or can't buy tickets, go see it on TV. And thanks for joining me this week.
Thanks very much, Chris. Thanks for having me.